Well, if you got a Bible with you, if you want to turn to the book of Esther. Esther chapter 4. We came to Esther because we're kind of trying to follow as best we can the chronological story of the Israelites. And this is still the story of Israelites who are left in the realm of the exile after other Israelites have gone back home. It's a story that takes place in the Persian Empire. It's the story of the king Artaxerxes, or Ahasuerus, as he's described in this book, how he had thrown a party that lasted for 6 months and was trying to impress all of the people who were a part of his vast empire. And at one point in his party, he sent for his wife to come and present herself, Queen Vashti, and she refused. And so that started a whole series of events that in a lot of ways, as you're reading it, and especially if you begin to examine this book in light of Jewish perspectives, a large portion of this book ends up being a parody on the Persian Empire and the inability of this king who commands all of these various provinces to actually make a decent decision anywhere along the line, because he actually follows the counsel of his advisors, who tell him that he needs to depose Vashti, and so he deposes her. But years later, he thinks about it, he feels bad, he thinks, man, why did I do that? And he decides he's going to try to maybe patch things up with her, and his advisors again say, no, we've got to have a beauty contest and see who the prettiest girl in the land is and bring her in, and she can be your queen. And so that's what they did, and that's where we got introduced to Esther and her cousin Mordecai, who was basically taking the role of father for her. She'd lost her mother and father. They had died. And so while she's there, she's part of this contest, she becomes the queen, and Mordecai uncovers a plot to assassinate the king, and so he thwarts that plot. And then last week we looked at how an interesting character all of a sudden comes out of nowhere, a guy by the name of Haman, who is introduced, and he is given honor as a prince among the people, and so the people are supposed to bow to him as they would bow to a king, but Mordecai wouldn't do it. And we looked at that last time, that very well could have been a racially motivated issue. He didn't want to, you know, because the Amalekites were the sworn enemies of the Jewish people, he didn't want to bow to this guy because he was an Amalekite. And that prompted retribution from Haman that stretched way beyond Mordecai, and it turned into a great anti-Semitic campaign where he determined he was going to destroy all of the Jewish people. So he convinced the king to go ahead and sign into law something that would be irreversible, a decree that all the Jewish people of all the provinces were to be destroyed, and all the plunder that would come after they've destroyed all the Jewish people would go into the coffers of the king. They'd, you know, pad his bank account, and so he agreed to it. And that's where we left off. A decree had been signed by the king that they were going to destroy all the Jewish people, and he and Haman, the king and Haman, had sat down to a drinking party. And that's where it ended in chapter 3, so we pick up today in chapter 4. And we begin here in the first few verses. It says, when Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and he put on sackcloth and ashes, and he went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as to the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Okay, so Mordecai finds out about this decree, and he, when he learns his fate and the fate of his own people, he goes into this public mourning process, which is an interesting thing as we examine that, as we look at that. You know, this is a very public display of his distress that he feels that, you know, for obvious reasons. I mean, you know, as anyone would feel. But he goes right into the middle of the town, right up to the front of the king's gate. You know, you weren't allowed to go in and dressed in mourning clothes to go inside the king's gate. And many royal kingdoms held to that sort of a law, that they wouldn't allow people to mourn within the gates of their palace or whatever. And the idea is, you know, you never had court mourners. You always had court jesters and things like that. You know, you didn't want people to think that there was any reason to grieve because you're the greatest king in the world. And so, you know, you weren't allowed to do this. It was just bad PR. So, but publicly, he's basically out in the town square, and he is mourning openly, crying, and in a sense, in a way, this whole public display of sorrow and distress kind of carries with it an idea of almost like a public protest over what's going on. You know, you see this law being enacted, and so he's publicly, basically protesting. He's mourning this. You know, he's wearing sackcloth. The sackcloth is basically just rough rags. He's just, you know, the name itself explains itself. Sackcloth, something that's not the fine material, but the awful material that you'd put the potatoes in or whatever. But it's always been a sign of sorrow and mourning. What's interesting is what's left out of this passage, because as it's describing what Mordecai is doing in all of this, you notice that there's no mention in this that he begins to pray. It mentions that he's fasting, but there's no indication that he's praying. There's no indication that he's calling out to God. It's really interesting if you were to read this book and then read concurrently the book of Nehemiah, because Nehemiah begins in the Persian Empire. Nehemiah himself is a steward of the king, is a cupbearer for the king. And to look at the way he talks about God and prays before God and his heart is thinking about Israel, all of that's left out of this book. There is no mention that, you know, fasting, people will say, well, there's the connection right there. Fasting and prayer go together. But by and large, in scriptures, when you see them put together, the mention is there. Even down to the Ninevites, when Jonah goes and warns them of the coming disaster, when it says that they pray, they cry out to God and ask him to turn from his wrath. But you don't see that in this. Actually, you see a lot of times Amos talks about people fasting without there being anything behind it. Fasting because it's kind of a cultural, religious kind of behavior. So it's just interesting to me that you know, the writer of Esther seems to almost go out of his way to eliminate any concept of prayer or God or anything like that, to keep him completely in the secret places, to where we have to try to inject him with our mind alone. And I think that sometimes we've got to be careful, and I've talked about that already with this book. Sometimes we don't want to read this by inserting all the things that we think God would like to have everybody saying or thinking or doing, because it makes it more respectable, because I think we might miss the poignancy of what is left out. To me, it's very deliberate. Everything is being written specifically for this purpose, and I think there's a message even in this, in what's left out of this. And I think that's the challenge of reading Esther, to read what it really says and what it means to us, and not what we think, you know, it should be saying to us, because, you know, there's just no way around it. This has been an uncomfortable book. You go back and you look at the way the Alexandrian Jews, the early AD Jews, actually went in and rewrote the whole book, added in all kinds of prayers and different things, because it was obviously troubling to them. It's a very irreligious book, and, you know, it's kind of an embarrassment to everybody, you know, got a whole festival, you know, around the whole thing. And but I think, like I said, I think that there's something poignant in this. I think there's something we need to take away from that and recognize and realize that there's a message, even in the silence, about God. Okay, so verse 4. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them. Okay, so Esther is informed about Mordecai, you know, your cousin or whatever. I don't know if they understand the relationship. And this is that interesting thing. You know, she was supposed to keep her Jewish heritage a secret, and yet here are her, you know, maids and the other attendants coming in and telling her about Mordecai. So clearly they're at least aware of the connection between her and Mordecai. And they come in and they tell her that, you know, he's out in the city square and he's wearing potato sacks and he's crying and he's upset. Now, it's an interesting thing into this to me, too, that Esther clearly isn't privy to the news. I mean, you know, she's not aware of this decree at this point. She has to be informed that Mordecai is in mourning. So clearly she doesn't, there's no cable in the palace or something, because she's not aware of what's going down on the legal end of things. And she's clearly not among the lawmakers of the land, so that she knows what's going on there. But when she hears about his state, when she hears that Mordecai is out in the town square and he's mourning, she gets really distressed. And the wording in the Hebrew is is very interesting because the wording actually means to writhe, like you're in pain. When it says she's really distressed, you could actually translate that. She was writhing around in distress over his state. And it is so interesting to me that her first efforts aren't to find out what it is that's causing him to mourn. You notice that in this? When she's, you know, the first thing that she wants to do is send him a new set of clothes. Well, that'll cheer him up. I mean, you know, surely that he should be okay by that. I think that that's a very interesting insight into what's going on here with Esther. But, you know, I think that in itself is telling. It tells us a little bit about Esther right now. Again, we want to be careful that we don't build up the characters of the Bible and put them on a plateau or a level that isn't realistic or isn't what the Bible is portraying. A lot of times we keep wanting to create a hero of faith in Esther and this paragon of godliness and saintliness, and yet I don't know that the Bible really portrays that kind of picture. This little bit of a detail here is telling to me. She doesn't want to know. She doesn't seem to be concerned as much with why he's in mourning like that. She's more concerned that he is mourning. And you wonder why. Why? Why is she concerned about that? Why does she want to get him to change his behavior all of a sudden? Is it because he's close to the palace? Does that put him in danger by being close to the palace that way and mourning like that? Worse than that, is it an embarrassment to her? The fact that the attendants are the ones who come in saying, "Have you seen that guy down there? What a goof, man. He's down there crying and making a scene." And is she embarrassed? Is she part of the royal scene now? And she's looking at that thinking, "Oh, Mordecai," and, you know, gathering up some clothes and sending it out to him to try to get him to quit this behavior because it doesn't look good. But her lack of curiosity about the cause of his sorrow is strange to me. And I think it could very well, I'm not saying for sure, but I'm saying it could very well belie a certain shallowness on Esther's part, at least to me as I'm reading that. But Mordecai, you know, refuses the change of clothing. I don't want any clothes. This is clothes. He doesn't take the clothes from them and sends it back. So verse 5, then Esther called Haltak, one of the king's eunuchs whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. Okay, so now we want to find out. So Haltak went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasury to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king and make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. Okay, so now Esther wants to find out what's going on. Okay, you know, you don't want the clothes. I get it. This is serious. I see what you're trying to say here. Something's going on. So it must be, you know, this is more than just a cry for attention. You know, Mordecai really has got a problem here, so she wants to know what it is. So she sends out her servant, the servant who's attending to her, directly to Mordecai to get the skinny on what's happening here, what it is that's causing all this. You know, why won't you cut this out? What's happening? So Mordecai, and the wording of this is interesting. Mordecai reports to Haltak, all that has happened to him. So it's very personal for Mordecai. He's pointing out, you know, everything that's happened to me. And obviously that includes all the Jewish people, but this is why he's in the state that he's in. And informs him about the sum of money that is promised to the treasury in return for the destruction of the Jews. And once again, I have to look at that and think, now how did he know that? I mean, once more, we have Mordecai in a position where he's privy to some things that you normally wouldn't think that somebody like that would be privy to. Like, how did he know that that assassination attempt was going to take place? The text doesn't tell us. How did he know this? I doubt that that was in the public decree, but maybe it was. But it seems more like something that he's bringing to light because he's trying to show everybody the heinous injustice of this thing. This is for money, you guys. You got to pay attention. This is like a hired hit on the Jewish people. They're offering to pay them money to destroy my people. So, you know, by openly talking about that, I think that's part of his protest. He's trying to make it clear. But how did he know that? Again, we don't know. He couldn't have gotten it from Esther because Esther didn't even know what was going on. Esther's got to find out from him what's happening there. And he even provides Hatak a copy of the law that's been posted around town. And it's interesting, too, that he gives him instructions to explain it to her. Now, I don't know what that's supposed to imply. But actually, I do know what it's supposed to imply, that Esther, as a common girl, she grew up in a common home, more than likely was illiterate. More than likely, that's not, you know, she's only been there in the palace for a year. It's more than likely that she's not able to comprehend or get all of that, just from the purely logistical standpoint that she may not be able to read. And that would have been true for most common girls. I mean, girls of a common upbringing. So he sends this copy of the written law, and the written law, the fact that it is a written decree, is so important in the context of the Persian Empire, remember. We've talked about that before, how other kings that reigned before Xerxes and before the Persians, well, they had autonomy. I mean, they had, you know, you talk about the king of Babylon, you know, he was in total control. But for the Persians, it was a different story. For them, the rule had this, the law had the supreme rule. The law, any law that was decreed, became the thing that all people, including the king, had to be subject to. So this was extremely serious. I mean, it revealed the gravity of the problem before them. This was huge. This has been a law written into law by the hand of the king with his seal. This was irreversible based on the way they understood things. So the problem before them was gigantic. And so he encourages Esther that there's one solution, there's one viable solution that he can see, and that would be is if Esther will go in there and talk to her hubby on behalf of the Jews. If you just go in there and talk to the king and explain to him the situation, maybe we can figure out a way to reverse this. Maybe he can write a new law, which would be the only way you could do it. He'd have to decree something new that would work to counter what he's already put into law at this point. Okay, so this is what he's told Esther. I want you to, you know, go in and talk to the king. So verse 9, so Hatak returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Then Esther spoke to Hatak and gave him a command for Mordecai. So, you know, going back and forth. He's just a messenger for them right now. So this is what she's saying to him. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called has but one law, or put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go to the king these 30 days. And so they told Mordecai Esther's words. Okay, so earlier in the book, I don't know if you remember this, but earlier in the book it was talking about how when she was hiding the fact that she was Jewish, she was doing that because Mordecai had told her to, and it even qualified that saying because she always obeyed what Mordecai told her to do, always. And twice in there it mentions that she always did what Mordecai commanded, even after she had become queen of the land. But here, I believe the reason that those things were put in there is to provide a stark contrast with what happens right here. Because in this case, when he goes and sends this message to her saying, you've got to go before the king, her answer, in short, is basically, no way. There's no way I'm going to go do this. Are you crazy? This time she's balking at this. And for one reason, she explains, is that it's not legal. I can't, you know, the law states that nobody can just waltz in and talk to the king. You have to be invited in to see the king. And there's only one way that you can even receive mercy if you go in uninvited. And that is if the king decides to grant mercy to your intrusion by holding out the royal scepter and granting you permission to come in and interrupt whatever it is that he's doing. So she's saying, since I can't go uninvited, because I have no idea what he would do. I mean, that's just an absolute, you know, roll of the dice there. She said her only chance would be is if the king did invite her, if the king would go ahead and invite her on up into the palace. And that was a problem, she said, because the king hadn't seen her or invited her there for a month. Now, how would you like a marriage like that? And some of you are probably thinking, yay, no. But I would hope not. But I would hope not. But the you know, so this is a problem, and again, we get a better insight as to what the relationship. You know, I know in the movies and everything, we like to portray a beautiful romance between Esther and the king, and they walk, you know, hands in hand, and it's just lovely and stuff. But in reality, I mean, the reality of this as a in this patriarchal society where he is the king, she is queen, but she is still one among many women that the king, you know, has at his disposal, and so he hasn't called for her in a month. She's been over in the queen's quarters where, you know, whatever's going on, just watching daytime TV. Nothing's really been going on or anything like that in her life. And so she, you know, she's trying to say that I can't just go waltzing in there, and he hasn't invited me, and I haven't, you know, we can't fault Esther for not wanting to do this. I mean, can we? I mean, we can't fault her for saying, I'm not going to do this. Are you crazy? Because obviously the risk for her is extreme. I mean, what he's asking her to do, and you can actually start to put it together what her thought processes are, because she's in the palace. I mean, she's queen. From her perspective, she's insulated from this trouble. Yeah, you guys are in trouble. I'm a queen, remember? Why would I put myself at risk like this? I'm not going to go do this. You know, she knows that she doesn't have a close relationship with the king that she can use as leverage. I mean, if she does this, it's gonna take a miracle. And there's nothing in this text that indicates to us that Esther had any intention that God was gonna do any kind of miracle. She said flat out, no, I'm not gonna do this. I'm not, you know, I don't want to do this. Her hope was hinging on the idea that hidden away in the palace, she would be safe. And even though it put Mordecai at risk and maybe the other Jewish people, she herself felt insulated. But here, I believe anyway, here is where we get to the very heart of the message that's being communicated to us through the book of Esther. And the story goes on in verse 13. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, and I don't know who them is. Apparently, they got several messengers going back and forth. You know, it's hard to have an argument with somebody when through messengers. So people are running back and forth, another message from her. So anyway, Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you'll escape the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. But if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Okay, so Mordecai all of a sudden is playing hardball with his cousin. And, you know, clearly the situation is severe enough that he's got to deal with this and be right up front with her. And we got to really kind of break this down, what's being said here, because, like I said, I believe wholeheartedly that this is one of the major messages that the book of Esther is communicating to us. First, he's telling her, you know, this is the basis of his argument to her. You know, he's telling her, just because you're the queen, just because you're there in the palace, just because you feel insulated from all of this, as a Jewish person, Esther, you will not be safe. That's what he's trying to get across. Your hope that somehow you're insulated from this, your hope that somehow you're safe from the arm of the enemy that's trying to destroy us all is an illusion on your part. It's a myth that you're kidding yourself with. You know, and he's trying to say to her that she's unwilling to put herself in danger to help her people, but he's trying to show her that sense of security that you have that makes you think you don't want to be put in danger is an illusion. You're in danger. You've got to see that. You've got to see that this situation is just as real for you as it is for anyone else, that the real danger here for Esther is doing nothing. The real danger, the real problem that exists for Esther is if she falls back into the comfort of the palace saying, I will be okay, this won't affect me. The real danger for her and for all the Jewish people is if she takes that route. Next thing that he says is actually quite mysterious, and people have puzzled over this for a long time. Traditionally, verse 14 is thought to be a veiled reference to God delivering Israel. He says to her, you know, if you just remain silent, if you don't do anything, then deliverance will come to Israel from another place, but your father's house and you will perish. And this is a real curious thing here, because if this is well, there's a lot of different problems with it, and I don't want to get too complicated in trying to explain this, but Saying this, if he is saying this, if he's saying, if you don't help us, deliverance will come from somewhere else. And again, you notice that he's not saying God will deliver us. He's just very ambiguously saying deliverance will come from another place. It's a weird way of deflating his own argument, if you think about that. By saying, if you don't do this, well, somebody else will. It's kind of like a cheerleader out there. Bill, he's our man. If he can't do it, somebody else will give it a shot. I don't know. It deflates everything that he's trying to get across in this. He's saying to her, if you don't do this, someone else will, or some other way the Jews will get through this. And then he adds this last part on that's just a strange kind of thing to put in this. I mean, a strange conclusion, a strange apodosis at the end of this sentence here, a conclusion drawn that doesn't really match what's happening in the first part of it. Because he says, if you don't do this, we'll be delivered somehow, and you and your family will die. Well, one thing is her family's dead. Remember? That's why she's living with Mordecai. Her father's already gone. He's already dead. And what is this? Is this a threat? I mean, that's what it sounds like. If we read it just as it's there, it sounds like he's saying, okay, you don't do this, we'll still get out of this, and then we're coming for you. We're taking you out because you wouldn't help us. Well, that paints him as an even worse character than we thought. Or is he, if he is making a veiled reference to God, he's saying God will get us out of this, but then God's going to kill you because you didn't help us. And that makes God look really bad as we look at this. So this is problematic, and it's been problematic for years as people have looked at this, trying to discern what it is that he's talking about here. Now, John Wiebe, a Hebrew scholar, years ago suggested a solution to this, which I think is a very interesting one, and many different teachers actually subscribe to it. Robert Deffenbaugh believes this. I'm inclined to agree with him. He suggests that verse 14 should not be an assertive statement. In other words, it's not making a statement. He isn't saying deliverance will come from somewhere else, but in reality, he is posing a rhetorical question, saying in essence, if you don't do this, where will help come from? And you remember in the Hebrew, there's no punctuation in that. So we've got to trust the translators to figure out the best kind of punctuation to put into it. And from his perspective, there's enough evidence within the way the structure of the statement is put together that you could easily turn this into a rhetorical question. You could even read it in the English and get that. Because if you were to put this, if you were to read it, like I just read it a minute ago, for if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place. You see the difference in that? In other words, he's saying, where else is it going to come from? If you don't step up and help us right now, Esther, where is our help going to come from? Who is going to do this? You're in the position to make a difference right now. Will you do the right thing? And there we have the nucleus of what it is the book of Esther is trying to tell us. All through this, we've got a picture of these two Jewish people who are trying to make a home for themselves in the Persian Empire. God told them to go back to Israel. Oh, if I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand wither up and dry away. That's the concept. He wanted them to remain wholeheartedly in the promised land, even though they were in this time of exile. But here are these Jewish people who are trying to forge a home here in this foreign land, in this place outside of God's plan and purpose for the Israelites. And we see there that even there, even though it looks as though they're in a position of power and safety, even there, the world will never make a place for God's people. The world will never make a place for the people that God has held on to and that God has a plan and a purpose for. And that is coming across clearly in this, that no matter how well we try to ensconce ourselves in the society of the time, the danger, the threat is still there. Deliverance is still needed. And so for Esther and for Mordecai, it does no good to try to find a life in this world. It does no good to try to hide ourselves in the midst of this world, thinking that maybe all of these dangers will just pass us by if we assimilate, because the dangers are going to be there no matter what. We can't blend with the culture. There's going to have to come a time, and that's what Esther shows us in this book. There will come a time when who we really are will have to be exposed. Who we really belong to is going to have to come to light, and we are going to have to make a choice in life. We're going to have to defy the expectations and the norms of the world that we live in. We're going to have to do the right thing at the right time. And that's the challenge that's before her. When we're in a position, when we're in a place where the resource is available, where the challenge is there and the crisis of conviction is presented to us, we're called on, even by this. When he's saying, for such a time as this, it's somewhat about destiny, but it's more than anything else saying, you've got to do the right thing. Will you do the right thing at this right time? You're here in a position to make a difference. Man, that's a challenge for all of us who belong to the kingdom of God, all of us who live in exile in this world. Are we going to make a home here and try to hide and disappear and blend in with everything around us? If we do, it's not going to work. There will come a point in time when we're going to be called on. We have to do the right thing. We're called on to make a difference. We're here for that very purpose, for that very reason. To do nothing is the worst choice and by far the most dangerous choice that could ever be made. And that was true for her. So verse 15, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. Now it's Esther giving the orders. Esther's the one explaining what has to be done as she sees the proposition before her. You know, and the call goes out to fast night and day. And again, it's fasting without any mention of prayer, without any mention of supplication to God. We'll ask him for his favor or his help. There's nothing like that in there. Though I don't think we're wrong in recognizing that the hand of God is behind all of these things. You know, the beauty of this book is the very irreligious nature of it. God working in ways that he's not making himself absolutely, positively clear in the process, and yet his will is being done. So she's going to go ahead and break this civil law, and she's going to go to the king, and she makes this statement, which sometimes people will try to paint as a great statement of faith. If I perish, I perish. But really, a statement like that is far closer to fatalism. I mean, this isn't like the Hebrew children standing before King Nebuchadnezzar saying, you know, my God will deliver me, but if not, O king, know that we won't bow to anyone else. This is kind of more like sera, sera, you know, oh, if I die, I die, whatever. And I don't mean whatever. I don't think she's saying whatever. But from her side, she's just looking at this. I've got to do whatever I've got to do. And here's the other aspect that we see that this is all culminating toward, because when it comes to doing the right thing, we're realizing right here, couched in this story, the right thing involves self-sacrifice. The right thing is to demonstrate that kind of love that lays down its life for a friend. That her recognition, her realization in this is that if nothing is done, we'll all die. But if I go in there, I can make a difference. I may die, but I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to lay down my life in order to make the difference that's necessary here. So we can't hide, we can't ignore it, we can't hide, we can't ignore the calling that's before us. We can't assume that we're somehow insulated from the danger of a world that wants nothing to do with God's people. But we're called to take that risk of living in such a way that doing the right thing means willing to lay down our lives, to live sacrificially in love for other people. So, so when it comes to doing this, she's seeing that she's going to have to live for something bigger than just herself, live for something more than just the pleasures of the palace at this time, and all of that. She's got to live in such a way that her life is going to make a difference. You were born for such a time as this. Who knows? That's what Mordecai says. This is your destiny. This is your calling. This is why you're here. And ultimately, that's what we look at in our own lives. This is our calling. Now, this was an important message for the Jewish people to understand. And as this, as this whole book closes down, we'll see how this is explaining the holiday of Purim. But this was important for the Jewish people as well. This book. Because from the subsequent empires that rose up afterwards, the cultures that they got involved in, one of the biggest challenges that they faced. One of the biggest temptations that the Jewish people faced was assimilation into those cultures. When the Greeks took power, the Hellenization of the Jews, the trying to turn the Jewish people into Greeks and to eliminate their religion. And it was very successful for a lot of the Jewish people. But the lesson of Esther is that that's not going to work. That's not going to be the means by which we're going to find fulfillment or contentment in this life. Later on with the Romans, the same concept was happening. They were turning the Jewish people into Roman citizens and trying to assimilate them into their culture. And for many of them, it worked. But the message of Esther still comes back. It's never going to provide the satisfaction, the fullness, the wholeness that you're looking for. It can't be found here. And of course, even as citizens of the kingdom, that's what we remember. This place is not our home. This world that we live in as it is right now. Now there's coming a day when the king is going to restore it to what it was supposed to be. There's going to be that great marriage supper of the Lamb, where the things of the kingdom of God and the realm of the king are married to the realm of this earth, and it's going to be a new heavens and a new earth. And that's the thing we hold out as the hope that we have. But this world, this place, this culture, this anything that's here, this isn't home. This is the stuff that we deal with, we live with, that we have available. And while we have it available to us, we constantly need to be challenged in our own hearts. What will I do with what I've been given? What will I do with this place that I'm in life? Will I make a difference? Will I answer that call? Will I do the right thing at the right time and represent the king the right way? So it's stuff to think about and take with us, and we'll see how this all goes down next time. So Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the challenge that's in this strange book that leaves your name out of it, that leaves prayer out of it, can be so challenging, convicting to us, Lord. As we examine our own lives, we realize how you work in the lives of your people. We realize the challenges that are in front of us all the time as we reconcile the life we have here with the citizenship we have in your kingdom. So guide us and lead us in this. Help us be the people who do the right thing. Help us be the people that make a difference in this world. We pray that, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.